Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has rejected Western claims that Iran is seeking a nuclear weapon, once again confirming Tehran's nuclear program is entirely peaceful. Police continue to scuffle in Canada with protesters over vaccine mandates and COVID restrictions. And deadly floods and mudslides in Brazil leave over 100 dead, hundreds still missing, as authorities are still clearing debris and trying to find survivors. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has rejected Western claims that Iran is seeking a nuclear weapon, once again confirming Tehran's nuclear program is entirely peaceful. Ayatollah Khamenei also noted that Iran will further develop its peaceful nuclear capacity to maintain its independence. Sooner or later, the leader added, the Islamic Republic will be in need of nuclear energy. Ayatollah Khamenei recalled that he had cautioned the negotiators to include certain points in the initial deal when it was being drawn up back in 2015, but that those cautions were not heeded and therefore led to subsequent problems. He pointed out to production, collective efforts, and diplomacy as the way forward to neutralize the effects of economic pressure and sanctions. Political analyst Mostafa Khoshchesh said that the U.S. seeks to use Iran's nuclear program to demonize the Islamic Republic and to contain its regional and missile power.
What the Iranian leader said was reiterating, he was reiterating once again that Iran is very much resolved to maintain its peaceful nuclear program. Despite the many inspections that have been carried out on Iranian nuclear, civilian nuclear industries, that included the largest number of man hours of inspections before the JCPOA and after that, of course, United States is just using the Iranian nuclear program in order to demonize Iran without providing any kind of proof in order to advance its containment program that consists of the ultimate objective of containing Iran's power components in various areas of nuclear industry, regional power and missile power. So Iran is in the know. Iran knows what they are doing, and it wants to, you know, diffuse their containment plan if possible. If not, as the Iranian Supreme Leader reiterated, the main road towards salvation and getting rid of these pressures is diffusing the sanctions and the impact of this weapon of choice for the United States that's reinvigorating the Iranian economy.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA continue talks in the Austrian capital to revive the accord. Ali Bagherikiani, Iran's top negotiator, has called on parties to be realistic and avoid excessive demands. Tehran also insists that the revival of the accord hinges on the removal of U.S. sanctions. We spoke to our Vienna-based correspondent, Homolezgi, earlier for some details.
Mr. Bagheri, after a long time of no tweets or no official comments, did make a tweet yesterday, last night, and you just referred there to the comments that he made, saying that now is the time for decisions. And this just after we heard the French foreign minister saying that it's Iran that has to be making the political decisions. Now, Mr. Bagheri saying that now is the time for the Western sides, and sources have been saying this for some time now, particularly the U.S., to make the necessary political decisions to get things moving. The sources close to the talks are saying that an agreement is indeed within reach. Yesterday, the Chinese delegate addressing reporters here said that he believes that we are in the last stage of the negotiations and it's just days away. And however, sources say there are still a few remaining issues that need to be resolved. And we're hearing, of course, one of them is the issue of guarantees that the U.S. will not violate the JCPOA again, will not withdraw from it again, if that is possible. And we're also, of course, hearing that among the other remaining issues is the scope of sanctions that have been imposed when it comes to individuals, various entities under other labels, Iran insisting on its demand that it wants all of those sanctions to be removed. So those are among the issues that were that are still up for discussions and negotiations. But as far as Iran is concerned, if the political decision is made, we're not very far now from an agreement to restore the JCPOA.
In Albania, concerns are growing over the criminal activities of the anti-Iran terrorist group known as Mujahideen Haq organization. A judicial document leaked by Albanian media says an MKO member has been prosecuted for armed robbery. A document says the MKO member has admitted to robbing a bar and a pharmacy last year. The document specifies a member has previous convictions. Latest controversy comes 2 months after reports emerged that other MKO members based in a camp near the capital of Tirana were involved in human trafficking and drug smuggling between 2019 and 2021. Albanian media says the country's police have alerted the U.S. Embassy of the group's involvement in criminal activities. The Albanian police deny sending any letter to the American embassy without elaborating. Critics in Albania blame the U.S. for providing protection for the terrorist cult. U.S. removed the MKO from its terror blacklist in 2012. The group now enjoys freedom of activity in the U.S. and Europe and even holds regular meetings where European and American officials participate. Olsi Jazizi is an Albanian historian and social activist. Now, he joined us earlier to provide more details over the latest controversy surrounding the MKO terror group. He says the MKO, supported by the U.S. Embassy, frequently bribes or blackmails Albanian prosecutors and police to escape prosecution.
Reports have been leaked from Albanian police where a number of high commanders of the Mujahideen command, people like Narges Abrishamci, who is the sister-in-law of Mariam Rajavi, and the sister of her first husband, Mehdi Abrishamci, and other top commanders of the Mujahideen, they have been arrested for smuggling drugs to Italy. Other commanders have been arrested for taking illegal refugees from Greece and sending them to Italy and then to France. We don't know who these people are. They can be jihadi fighters of Daesh and ISIS. They can be suicide bombers. They can be people who have committed huge human rights violations and crimes in Syria. And this is so worrying for the Albanian government, the Albanian police. Now, the case against the Mujahideens has been continuing for a number of years in Albania. But in the past, Mujahideens have been very good on bribing our prosecutors, on using the U.S. Embassy in Albania to blackmail Albanian prosecutors, judges, and police. But now this issue has exploded because this is huge.
Israel says it will not cooperate with the U.N. inquiry into abuses committed in occupied Palestinian territories, accusing head of the investigation of bias. The regime says that Navi Pillay has had numerous anti-Israel pronouncements and championed an anti-Israel agenda. Tel Aviv did not provide any instances for such an allegation. A spokesman for Israel's foreign ministry says that Pillay's appointment was, quote, a disgrace. Pillay served as a UN rights chief from 2008 to 2014 and also served as a judge with the International Criminal Court. The United Nations Human Rights Council set up an inquiry commission last year to probe Israel's violations of international humanitarian and human rights law during its 11-day war on the Gaza Strip last May. Panels also mandated to investigate Israel's violations in East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Police in Canada detained a number of demonstrators in the capital, Ottawa, as truckers and their supporters continue to block roads to protest COVID restrictions. Arrests come less than 2 hours after a city's police chief warned protesters of imminent action to clear them from downtown Ottawa. Truckers opposing COVID vaccine mandates, known as the Freedom Convoy, have blocked roads in the capital's downtown area for nearly 3 weeks and temporarily shut border crossings with the United States. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has warned that the move is threatening public safety and damaging the country's economy. We earlier spoke to international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, who briefed us on efforts by the Canadian government to put an end to anti-vaccine demonstrations. Here he is.
The government is, for the first time, invoking the Emergency Act. It's never been used before, so it still has to be explored and tested. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association is launching a challenge to the court, saying that to the law, saying that it's unconstitutional and it is not proportional. There is some argument to say that this is maybe an overreaction on the part of the government, but the law is the government invokes it, and it has to be debated, and the debate's going to take place on Monday. If the parliament passes it, it maintains it. If they reject it, then the law ends. It's only enforced for 30 days, but it does allow seizure of bank accounts, seizure of trucks, taking away driver's licenses. Also, it prevents children from being involved, because there's a lot of children actually living in the trucks and staying with the protesters. And it prevents people from providing fuel, food, and other material assistance to the truckers.
Brazil's city of Petropolis has been hit by heavy rains, and almost the heaviest, that is, in almost a century. Ensuing mudslides and floods have left at least 117 people dead. The toll is expected to rise as the region reels from the downpours. Dozens of people are also still missing. Constant rain has disrupted efforts to find survivors and clean up debris. A Brazilian official has compared the affected region to a war zone. President Jair Bolsonaro has pledged federal assistance to help the population and start rebuilding the area. Since December, heavy rains have triggered deadly floods and landslides throughout much of Brazil. They threaten to delay harvests and have forced the suspension of mining operations in many areas. France and its allies have announced that they'll withdraw troops from Mali following nearly a decade of their military presence in the African country. In a statement, France and its African and European partners cited multiple obstructions by Mali's ruling junta for their decision. The French president also said attitudes of the junta forced his country to have to pull out its troops. Emmanuel Macron completely rejected the idea that France failed its former colony. Relations between the two nations have been strained since the 2020 coup in Mali. Local officials have already demanded French troops leave the country. There have also been public protests calling for the withdrawal of the French military. France deployed troops in its former colony back in 2013 under the pretext of fighting terrorists, but Paris-led operations have failed to quell the violence there. And earlier, Lawrence Freeman, political commentator, joined us for his take on what's going on in Mali.
Well, there's no question that the French involvement has not worked. I think they started there early 2013. I was there in the summer, maybe June, July of 2013. I knew at that point, I thought that the French operation wouldn't work. I don't think the French really understood what they were up against. And the other problem is the lack of a component of economic development for the entire Sahel is a constant problem for the West, United States, Europe. They don't understand the importance of actually economic development as a way of helping people so they won't support these extremists. The situation recently has been an increasing wave of anti-French resentment. There have been demonstrations and all kinds of activity going on in Mali where they're targeting the French, and the French probably deserve it as their French colonial master from the previous period. There's a lot of anger and legitimate anger and rage about what the French have done and what the French have not done.
Tensions between Washington and Moscow show no sign of abating. Now, Russia says it's expelled the U.S. deputy ambassador to Moscow in a tit-for-tat move. The Russian foreign ministry announced in a statement that the U.S. deputy chief of mission, Bart Gorman, has been ordered to vacate the country. The ministry said the move was in response to the expulsion of the minister counselor of the Russian embassy in Washington, accusing the U.S. of unleashing a visa war. The U.S. has reacted to the deportation of its second most senior diplomat, calling it an escalatory step. State Department says it is considering a response. Moscow once again dismisses as baseless Western accusations that Russia is planning an imminent invasion of Ukraine. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister also criticized Ukraine for what he called a lack of desire to get into direct dialogue to defuse tensions. Sergei Vershinin made the remarks during a UN Security Council session on Ukraine. Addressing the meeting, the U.S. Secretary of State reiterated claims by Washington and NATO that Russia is planning to fabricate a pretext to invade Ukraine in the coming days. He said pretext could include a fake or real attack using chemical weapons. Earlier on Thursday, the Russian foreign minister slammed the West for his continued hysteria over an alleged invasion despite drawdown of Russian forces near the Ukrainian border. Earlier, our Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes joined us with an update on the West-Russia tensions over Ukraine.
And we see a buildup of NATO troops further and further east, which is very provocative, analysts say, in terms of Russia's position. But you see the rhetoric is being constantly built up. I mean, Liz Truss talked about the fact that Joe Biden said last week that Nord Stream 2, that it will be blocked if there is an invasion of Ukraine. And of course, the West talks a lot about, you know, Ukraine being a sovereign, independent, autonomous nation, which is fair enough. But at the same time, you have a private contract between Germany and Russia in terms of Nord Stream 2, a gas pipeline, which has nothing to do with the EU. It has nothing to do with the United States. And yet you have Joe Biden saying that it will be blocked. Well, where's the autonomy? Where's the independence of Germany? Where's the respect for Germany's independence in this regard? And then you have Liz Truss parroting the same sentiments just in the past hour. So there's a lot of hypocrisy going here. And as EU leaders meet and as NATO defense ministers hold their final day of meetings here in Brussels today as well, it's clear that there are divisions.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Researchers say human-caused climate change is a significant driver of destructive conditions as even drier decades lie ahead. We now present you an article written by Gabrielle Cannon. The piece is titled, New Study Says U.S. West Mega Drought is Worst in at least 1,200 Years. The article has been published in the journal Nature Climate Change. American West has spent the last two decades in what scientists are now saying is the most extreme mega drought in at least 1,200 years. In a new study published on Monday, 14th of February, researchers also noted that human-caused climate change is a significant driver of the destructive conditions and offered a grim prognosis. Even drier decades lie ahead. Park Williams, a climate scientist at the University of California at Los Angeles and the study's lead author, says, anyone who has been paying attention knows that the western United States has been dry for most of the last couple of decades. Park Williams added, we now know from these studies that that is dry not only from the context of recent memory, but in the context of the last millennium. Turning up the temperature the result of human-caused global warming, has played a big part. The researchers write other studies show how the climate crisis will increasingly enhance the odds of long, widespread and severe mega-droughts. Noting that, as the West is now in the midst of the driest 22-year period in knowable history, this worst-case scenario already appears to be coming to pass. The research builds on conclusions from a previous study, also led by Park Williams, that ranked the period between 2000 and 2018 as the second driest in 12 centuries. The last two incredibly dry years, which were marked by record-setting heat waves, receding reservoirs and a rise in dangerously erratic blazes that turned both uncontrollably and unseasonably, were enough to push this period into first. Looking at moisture levels in soils, the team of client scientists from the University of California at Los Angeles, NASA, and Columbia University focused on landscapes from Montana to northern Mexico, north to south, and from the Pacific Ocean to the Rocky Mountains. They analyzed data collected three-ring patterns that offered clues to soil moisture levels throughout the centuries. Rings that appear closer together show the stunted growth patterns occurring during dry times. The researchers found so-called mega-droughts, which are characterized by prolonged periods of dryness that span more than two decades, were woven throughout history. Long before human industry, water availability ebbed and flowed naturally. However, that variability has been intensified by the climate crisis. According to their findings, soil moisture deficits doubled in the last 22 years compared with the levels in the 1900s. Human-caused warming accounted for a 42% increase in severity. Worryingly, the researchers warned the Western United States is experiencing a point of an upward trajectory. There have been many studies showing the connection between human-caused global warming, drought, and how these climate catastrophes compound. A large body of research has shown how heat waves will get larger, more extreme, and more frequent. But the evidence offered in this study casts these conditions into broader historical context, showing just how rapidly and how steeply these changes are developing. Experts and advocates hope it will serve as a call to arms to prepare for a future that is fast approaching. Already, unsustainable systems have started to crack. Park Williams says, "We are watching our bank account of water decline, and we know that eventually we need to slow our expenditures before the account runs out." The effects already being felt across western United States. In the summer of 2021, both Lake Mead and Lake Powell, the largest reservoirs in North America, reached record low levels. Nearly 65% of the American West is experiencing a severe drought, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor, even after record rainfall hit some areas late last year. For the first time, federal officials curbed allocations from the Colorado River Basin, which supplies water and power for more than 40 million people. Wildfires in the last 2 years have left behind more blackened earth than ever before and performed feats never thought possible. So far, conditions this year have not helped to turn the situation around. California saw one of the driest Januaries on record. February has already delivered heat waves that broke records across the state. By the start of this month, the snowpack has dwindled to below average, melting rapidly after reaching 160% of average at the start of the year. Forecasts show there's little short-term relief in sight. Alvar Escribabu, a senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California's Water Policy Center, says, "This study highlights the point that we need to reassess our resources. We can no longer assume that we have enough water for all the things that we want." Escribabu specifically called on California to reduce its agricultural footprint. Alvar Escribabu claims that important steps have been taken to better manage the issue and update operation rules. But he says climate change is outpacing us. According to Jason Smerdon, a climate scientist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory of Columbia University, who worked with Park Williams on the study, the crisis is a slow-motion train wreck. Jason Smerdon said, "These multi-decade periods of dryness will only increase with the rest of the century." Still, Jason Smerdon cast the conclusions in a more hopeful light. The extreme events taking place right in people's backyards may spur understanding and action. He says, "Knowing is half the battle," adding, "We have a lot of challenges in front of us, but we all have agency in the face of this, and there are pathways we can take that are much more sustainable and involve much less risk than the burn, baby, burn approach that we would take if we didn't do anything." Park Williams described water patterns in the United States, in Western United States, as a yo-yo, sometimes high, sometimes low, claiming only one-fifth of the current mega-drought could be attributed to human-caused climate crisis. Meanwhile, hundreds of scientists met virtually at the two-week Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, to lay out their latest findings on climate change and to present their evidence on how greenhouse gas emissions were impacting the globe, speeding evaporation and disrupting weather patterns. The Geneva-based United Nations organization will produce a summary of the studies for policymakers, outlining line-by-line economic, food security, biosphere, health and mental health strategies to decrease the detrimental effect of climate change. The summary is due to be published on 28th of February 2022.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and our condolences to you all on the martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Zainab Kubra, peace be upon her, the granddaughter of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Let us reflect on her words when addressing the tyrant Yazid in his court. "The end of all tyrants is terrible, and God knows the misguided and wrongdoers amongst you."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawa'ij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kazim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام في وصيته لهشام بن الحكم: يا هشام، ما قسم بين العباد أفضل من العقل، نوم العاقل أفضل من سهر الجاهل، وما بعث الله نبيا إلا عاقلا حتى يكون عقله أفضل من جميع جهد المجتهدين، وما أدى العبد فريضة من فرائض الله حتى عقل عنه.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, in his advice to Hisham ibn al-Hakam, stated, O Hisham, nothing has been bestowed upon the servants better than the intellect. The sleep of a man of intellect is better than the night vigil of an ignorant man. Every single prophet that Allah has sent down has been a man of intellect, whose intellect supersedes the labor of all diligent workers. The servant is not considered as having fulfilled an obligatory act from among the acts made incumbent by Allah until he understands it.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, when we're talking about the beautiful conversations of the infallible imams, we cannot overlook the beautiful conversations of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, this divinely appointed imam who suffered at the hands of the tyrannical government of his time. But despite his sufferings and hardships that he had to go through, we still find that he was able to put forth and give a light of guidance to all those who are searching for it, even in the present time. So in one of these conversations that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam has with his companions, we find that His Eminence, Imam al-Kadhim, talks about generosity and the fact that we should have good manners. It's interesting, but we find that the infallible imams talked about similar things one way or the other. There are certain things, certain moral, ethical traits, which throughout have been spoken by them. One such trait and ethical, moral trait, is that of generosity. And so when talking about the idea of generosity and having good behaviors, good manners, good akhlaq, good ethics and morals, we find that Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam in this conversation says to his companions, the generous and polite person is under the protection of Allah, and Allah does not leave that person until He Himself makes that individual enter the garden of paradise. He then continues and says, Allah sends out none as a prophet except one who is generous. And my father, the divinely appointed imam, recommended to me generosity and good manners. Dear brothers and sisters, it's interesting. We get so many different lessons and pieces of advice from this conversation. One of the most amazing things that we learn here is that the generous person and the polite person is under the protection of the Almighty Allah. And can there be a protection greater than that of the Almighty Allah? And so when we are generous and we are polite and we have good manners with our fellow brothers and sisters, then the protection of Allah is with us. And not only that, but Allah guides us and makes us enter the gardens of paradise. Because of what? Because of generosity and because of being polite. And finally, one of the qualities and characteristics of the messengers sent by Allah is that they were generous. If we inculcate generosity and politeness in our daily lives, can you imagine how beautiful this world would become? Can you imagine how perfect this world would become if only we follow these pieces of advice and this wisdom given to us by the infallible imams? This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Someone by the name of Al-Amiri, he would walk past the Imam in Medina, he would curse the grandson of Rasulullah and his father. To the extent that the companions next to Imam Musa ibn Ja'far would say, Ibn Rasulullah, let us deal with him. Imam says, leave him to me, I will deal with him my way. A few days later, he goes to his farm, to the farm of this man by the name of Amiri. He sits inside the farm. One narration says that he was on a donkey. The donkey steps on some of the crops. The man is even further angered. He looks at Imam Musa ibn Ja'far and says to him, how dare you spoil my crop? Imam says to him, how much did you spend in order for your farm to be in this present state? He said, 100 dinar. He said, how much do you expect to get yearly from the selling of the crops of this particular farm? He said, 200 dinars. Imam alayhi salam, after joking with him, after making him at ease, the narration tells us, he picks up 300 dinars and says to him, here, this is for you. This man is mesmerized. All this time, this individual abusing and hurting the grandson of Rasulullah, yet Imam al-Kadhim responds back through generosity, through forbearance, through Kadhm al-Ghayth, not only Kadhm al-Ghayth. And at that moment, the man falls onto the feet of the Imam and says, Allahu ya'lamu haythu yaj'alu risalata. Allah knows whom he would make his representative on this earth. He then goes back to his companions and he finds that this man, Al-Amiri, is with Imam Al-Kadhim walking and chatting and smiling. The companions are amazed. They are wondering what has happened. Imam alayhi salam says to them, did I not tell you that leave him to me? And then he would recite the following verse. لا تستوي الحسنة ولا السيئة ادفع بالتي هي أحسن فإذا الذي بينك وبينه عداوة كأنه ولي حميم. Allah gives us a constitution for akhlaq.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
The City of London usually welcomes arts and culture from all over the world, including Iran. In our next report, Bianca Rahimi will be taking us to a performance that fuses music from across the East.
A dream has become a reality. The Conference of the Birds, composed by the brilliant young musician Mehsan Marvasti and inspired by a poem of the same name written by poet Attar of Nishapur in the 12th century, performed here in London. It's a story all Iranians are familiar with, about an epic journey to find the Simurgh.
The Simurgh is to the east what the phoenix is to the west, a mythical creature that symbolizes transformation. And the story of the Simurgh is a spiritual one, full of courage, determination, and self-discovery.
I think it's the first time I've seen so prominently advertised a non-Western musical traditional concert, and I've got a long-standing interest in music from the different parts of the Islamic world. It kind of evokes sort of deeper feelings, spiritual feelings, and the fact that this specific concert is about kind of a spiritual poem, it taps into something which I think a lot of us are looking for, especially in this post-pandemic, current pandemic situation. We're looking for some deeper meanings. So I think it will be striking a chord for a lot of people.
It's a mix of fusion of different music, and that's always interesting. And it's Eurasian music, and it uses different instruments from across Asia to represent birds. And it just sounded lovely.
Even though there are differences, cultural differences between these places and these peoples, and those differences should be recognised in general, that through things like music and art, there can also be synergy, and like, yeah, things can work together as well.
5 years in the making, the Conference of the Birds, conducted by Farnoush Behzad, brought together musicians and instruments from across the world. It fuses Azeri, Chinese, Indian, Arabic, Afghan, Armenian and Persian music, brought to the audience by a Western orchestra. The performance was accompanied by two elocutionists who narrated the story and animated clips of birds and their migratory lives. The art and culture of Iran needs no introduction, renowned worldwide. But young Iranian artists living far from home are always looking for ways to capture the spirit of their homeland and offer Western audiences a taste of Iran. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Now, for those who are interested in archaeology, the remains of 14 mummies have been unearthed at an ancient site in central Peru. The mummies, believed to be over 1,000 years old, include 6 children and 8 adults. The tomb containing the bodies was found at an archaeological complex about 25 kilometers from the capital, Lima. Researchers discovered other objects such as clay pots, decorated calabashes, and some knitting gears near the mummies. They believe the children and adults were sacrificed in honor of a prominent local figure whose mummified body was found last November in the same area.
A group of people who were part of his environment were sacrificed, mainly children. It's quite possible that it was his children, his wives, who were sacrificed and buried in the surroundings of the tomb, and also his servants.
Van Dalen also says the discovery provides them with the oldest evidence of child sacrifice associated with the burial of an elite character in the pre-Inca era. The city of Cajamarquia, which was built out of mud in around 200 BC, is considered as one of the largest archaeological complexes in Peru.
A miniature bull in Germany's Bavaria is proving that size does not matter, as the small bovine makes himself comfortable in his new herd at an animal sanctuary. This tiny bull had a lucky escape and was rescued from a farmer who was taking him to a slaughterhouse. The mini cow is named Napoleon and was born with a genetic defect. Just 8 months old, the diminutive bull has already reached his full size. Napoleon might be small, but he is mighty and daring, as he is not afraid of joining a herd consisting of big and huge animals.
Napoleon belongs to the Dexter breed, which produces rather small cattle anyway. They grow up to be about 1.2 meters. With his 80 centimeters, he's of course far below that. Despite his size, he feels like a complete bull and is in a good mood. He has settled in with us very quickly, which we are very happy about. He also has a lively effect on the herd.
The little bovine now lives with 100 other rescued livestock. His rescuers say he gets along with other animals and has already become friendly with another rescued cow. The Dexter is a breed of cattle first originated in Ireland. They are usually bred for high-quality meat and milk. An Indonesian man frees a crocodile of a tire that was stuck around its neck some 6 years ago. Tilly, a self-taught rescuer and resident of Central Sulawesi province, captured the reptile and cut the tie using a small saw with the help of some locals. The animal had been too smart to be trapped. Tilly says he had been tracking the reptile for weeks using a basic trap with a rope tied to a log. He used live chickens and dogs as bait to lure the reptile. The crocodile drew the sympathy of local residents who worried the tire would choke as it grows in size. Tilly says his main motive was to help animals, claiming it was not his first experience dealing with a crocodile.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Biologists in Peru release two birds back to their natural habitat after weeks of efforts to attend and conserve dozens of animals affected by an oil spill. Two birds were among some 200 animals found dehydrated and were brought to a veterinary hospital for treatment. Veterinarians, biologists, and volunteers have been leading the cleanup operation of the affected coast close to the capital, Lima. So far, several species have been released after rehabilitation. An oil tanker off the coast of Peru was hit by waves triggered by a volcanic eruption miles away in Tunga in January. Some 6,000 barrels of oil spilled into the ocean that polluted waters and beaches along Peru's Pacific coast.
There are all sorts of peculiar restaurants around the world, but not so many prison-themed eateries. One of them is in the Iranian capital, Tehran, and it is thriving.
The setting is engaging. If we want to suggest it to someone, it's because of the setting too. It's like a cell, both its title and the story of the owners. They wrote here they were inmates themselves and why they were in jail.
Cell 16 serves its customers in cells where they can wear mock prison uniforms. The owners say they got the idea for their diner while they were behind bars for debt. They say they are now open to help newly released inmates who find it hard to get employed and give out part of their proceeds to pay for debt inmates.
There have been several cases where an inmate came and worked here while on leave, and we helped and offered him money to help his problem.
The eatery was opened in 2016. The owners have now expanded their business and own two diners in Tehran and another in the central city of Isfahan. They say they are using their emerging restaurant chain to raise funds to free convicts who are serving time for unpaid debts.
A German man has claimed a new Guinness World Record in hula hooping. Kia Sandmeier set a new record for the longest duration of hula hooping in a plank position. He was able to carry the activity in this difficult pose for over 6 minutes. The 30-year-old says he practiced the plank rigorously in the morning and evenings before and after work. Sandmeier says holding the plank was the most difficult part. The previous record for this activity was set last year by an American with just over 3 minutes. Every year, the Copenhagen Light Festival transformed the winter cold and darkness of the capital city into a celebration of light art in Denmark. In February, the entire city becomes the stage displaying captivating lighting installations presented by Danish and international artists. The works are planted at more than 30 historical sites, canals, and squares, among other urban spaces. Building facades are also decorated with special lighting designs. The organizers and curators of the festival say the event is important because it gives people a chance to rediscover their own city. Also, the event brings life to a dark season that's normally very quiet by offering joyful experiences for locals and tourists alike.
As the 2022 Winter Olympics have begun in the Chinese capital, Beijing, two playful giant pandas at the Moscow Zoo have come to the spotlight for predicting the outcome of the sports event. On the eve of the Winter Olympics opening, Ru Yi and Ding Ding were each offered 5 traffic cones labeled with national flags of the participating countries, represented by the largest numbers of athletes. the cones that got taken down by them were considered as the winners. The pandas then chose the cones with Chinese and German flags on them. Zoo officials say no treats were placed inside the cones to ensure that the prediction is unbiased. The zoo says it plans to continue the panda prediction for all individual and team competitions at the Games. The 15th edition of the Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has wrapped up. As Salman Khojouri reports, Iran ranks first globally for the number of cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council. Here's more.
The 15th Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has wrapped up its work. The four-day event brought together representatives of different sectors active in tourism and handicrafts fields, including airlines, cruise lines, hotels, museums, travel agencies, insurance services, travel and tourism facilities, and masters of handicrafts. The exhibition is considered as the most appropriate platform to optimize face-to-face communication among the involved industries. From a tourism point of view, Iran enjoys two important and unique features. The first one is Iran's exceptional geographical location among countries in the world, and the second feature is its tourism attractions of historical, cultural, natural pilgrimage, adventurous, and other sorts.
Qalamzani, or metal engraving, is an Iranian ancient metalwork art. It is engraved by chisels and hammers on different metals such as gold, silver, copper, brass, and some alloys. Its origin dates back to almost 7,000 years ago. It is the art of carving superb designs on various metals. The artistic work of this course made by the artists are the glorious and undeniable indication of previous metal work of Iran, and in particular Isfahan.
I'm from Hormozgan province, south of Iran. Handicrafts have always been an integral part of Hormozgan province due to the rich culture and special customs of the region. Hormozgan province embraces scenic islands, among which Kish, Hormoz, Hengam, and Qeshm are the most beautiful ones and top tourist destinations in southern Iran.
Iran has globally registered 11 cities and 3 villages under their native handicrafts during the past 6 years, making the country a world leader in registering local productions. There are totally 602 handicrafts fields identified on a global scale. 299 fields are special to Iran, from which 199 fields are in the central Iranian province of Isfahan.
With 14 entries, Iran ranks first globally for the number of cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council, as China with 7 entries, Chile with 4 entries, and India with 3 ones come next. Salman Khojouri, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The deadly impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the most deprived areas of England and Wales has been even more pronounced than first thought, according to research that reveals the northwest of England lost 3 times more years of life than the southwest. Deaths have been unevenly distributed socio-economically and geographically ever since the crisis began. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's health editor, Andrew Gregory. The piece is titled COVID impact in poorer areas of England and Wales worse than first thought.